Sitaraya, Krishna Basaya, Buddha, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta, Swami Phenomena, Namaste, Sarasiri, Dora Vandipana, Yurvishesha Shunya Varitascha Charisitaraya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 4, The Appearance of Sri Narada. And we're on text 9 today. Abhimanyu Sutam. Abhimanyu Sutam Sutta. Prahur Bhagavatotamam. Tasya Janma Mahascharyam. Karmani Chagrishnihina. Karmani Chagrishnihina. Abhimanyu Sutam Sutta. Prahur Bhagavatotamam. Tasya Janma Mahascharyam. Karmani Chagrinihina. Abhimanyu Sutam Sutta. Prahur Bhagavatotamam. Tasya Janma Mahascharyam. Karmani Chagrinihina. Abhimanyu Sutam, the son of Abhimanyu. Sutta, O Sutta, Prahu, it is said to be Bhagavata Uttamam, the first class devotee of the Lord. Tasya, his Janma, birth, Maha Ashcharyam, very wonderful. Karmani, activities, cha, and, grinihi, please speak to, na, us. Translation purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. It is said that Maharaj Parikshit is a great first-class devotee of the Lord, and that his birth and activities are all wonderful. Please tell us about him. Report. The birth of Maharaj Parikshit is wonderful because in the womb of his mother, he was protected by the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. His activities are also wonderful because he chastised Kali, who was attempting to kill a cow. To kill cows means to end human civilization. He wanted to protect the cow from being killed by the great representative of sin. His death is also wonderful, because he got previous notice of his death, and which is wonderful for any mortal being, and thus he prepared himself for passing away by sitting down on the bank of the Ganges and hearing about the transcendental activities of the Lord. During all the days he heard Bhagavatam, he did not take food or drink, nor did he sleep a moment. So everything about him is wonderful, and his activities are worth hearing attentively. Desire is expressed herein to hear about him in detail. Om Gyan Kananda Shaganan Jana Salakaya Chatsumi Kamina Tasmai Sri Gurvena Maha Panchakopa Tudisha Krika Sindhu Devacha Patitano Pavani Bill Vaishnavi Unamona Maha. So after some discussion about Shukadeva Goswami, now we are hearing about the glories of Maharaj Parikshit. And Maharaj Parikshit is indeed a very glorious devotee. He's glorious, as Prabhupada is pointing out here, in his birth, in his life, and his death. They're all wonderful. There are many great devotees described in the Srimad Bhagavatam and our other literatures, but rarely do we find such extraordinary descriptions. I was thinking about it that not only we hear, of course, many great devotees about their lives and their activities, but from the very beginning, Maharaj Parikshit's birth, even before his birth, is completely auspicious and a very wonderful pastime. His entire life is glorious. There's several chapters about him in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then, of course, his departure. What could be a more glorious departure than Maharaj Parikshit? In fact, the departure of Maharaj Parikshit is the whole story of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken to Maharaj Parikshit in the 7 days that he had before leaving his body. So the fact that this greatest literature in the world has been spoken to him by Shukadeva Goswami, recorded by Vyasadeva, and then retold to many others, shows what an extraordinary devotee Maharaj Parikshit is. So I thought today we should just talk about Maharaj Parikshit. It's wonderful to glorify these devotees and see what lessons we can learn from their lives. The pastimes of Maharaj Parikshit began before his birth, actually, within his womb, as we know. The story is, of course, that the battle of Kurukshetra is winding down. The Pandavas have more or less defeated their enemies. There's very little left, but Ashvatthama, the son of Dronacharya, is still up to his nefarious activities, and so he kills the five sons of Draupadi and in their sleep. Of course, obviously a very cowardly act for anybody to do. So this is, of course, the type of person Ashvatthama is. Then after that, not enough that he killed the five sons of Draupadi, he realized there was one remaining heir to the Pandu dynasty, and that was in the womb of Uttara, who was the husband of Abhimanyu, Abhimanyu being the son of Arjuna, there was the child. And that child, of course, is Maharaj Parikshit. So Ashvatthama went to kill the child that was in the womb of Uttara. So he sends a Brahmastra weapon, this incredibly powerful, fiery, Prabhupada just says the Brahmastra weapon is like a nuclear bomb. It's like a nuclear weapon. This is what he sends at a defenseless young woman. Of course, Abhimanyu had been killed in a battle for Kurukshetra, and that's a really wonderful story about that, and it took about 12 great warriors to defeat him. He was a great warrior, as his father Arjuna, and he was his son, Arjuna's son, right? Abhimanyu was Arjuna's son. No. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure thought. I wonder if I had that right for a moment. At any rate, the Brahmastra is coming. The Pandavas, everyone is there, Mother Kunti and the Pandavas are all there. They raise their weapons to try to defend it, but it's coming so fast they can't possibly counteract it. Krishna's there. Krishna, first of all, invokes the Sudarshan Chakra, and then he enters into the womb of Maharaj. Well, first of all, Uttara comes to Krishna. That is her shelter. She knows she has to surrender to Krishna. Nobody else can protect her at that moment, just before the Brahmastra is coming. And I always like this verse that Uttara speaks. Pahi Pahi Mahayogin Devadeva Jagatpate Nanyam Tvadabhayam Pashe Yatra Mrityu Parasparam. O Lord of Lords, Lord of the universe, you are the greatest of mystics. Please protect me, for there is no one else who can save me from the clutches of death in this world of duality. So, at that point, Krishna raises the Sudarshan Chakra, and he enters into the womb to give protection. So, I'll read a few verses from that part in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is in Canto 1, Chapter 12, verses 6 through 10. It says, O son of Bhrigusha, Shaunaka. This is Siddha Goswami speaking. Oh, it's hard to hear. Can maybe this volume go up? When the child Parikshit, the great fighter, was in the womb of his mother Uttara and was suffering from the burning heat of the Brahmastra thrown by Ashvatthama, he could observe the Supreme Lord coming to him. The Lord was only a thumb high, but he was all transcendental. He had a very beautiful, blackish, infallible body, and he wore a dress of lightning yellow and a helmet of blazing gold. Thus he was seen by the child. The Lord was enriched with four hands, earrings of molten gold, and eyes blood red with fury. As he loitered about, interesting expression, loitered about, his club was constantly encircling him like a shooting star. So he's got his Sudarshan Chakra, he has his club, it's like swirling around like a shooting star, totally protecting from the Brahmastra. The Lord was thus engaged in vanquishing the radiation of the Brahmastra, just as the sun evaporates a drop of dew. He was observed by the child, who thought about who he was. Well, thus being observed by the child, the Supreme Lord Personality of Godhead, the super soul of everyone, and protector of the righteous, who stretches in all directions and who is unlimited by time and space, disappeared at once. So that was the last that Maharaj Parikshit saw of Krishna. Now, after Krishna was on the planet, maybe a little while after Maharaj Parikshit was born, but he quickly disappeared. Everything was kind of wrapped up. The Pandavas went, they went back to Godhead. There was that whole incident where they weren't all killed. The whole Yadu dynasty was killed. They all timely departed. They all left. Krishna left. So Maharaj Parikshit was the only really one left from that dynasty. And of course, Krishna was no longer on the planet. So Krishna saved Maharaj Parikshit, Srila Prabhupada explains, for two reasons. One, because he was a great devotee, a totally surrendered, pure Mahabhagavat, so naturally Krishna protected him, but also because he was the last male heir to the Pandava dynasty. And if religious principles were going to continue, there had to be another great king, at least for a couple more generations before Kali Yuga really entered. Of course, there's Maharaj Parikshit and his son Janmanjaya, and I think maybe a couple others, and then you don't hear too much about great kings, because Kali Yuga had descended by that point, and that's pretty much the end of these wonderful dynasties. So, for the rest of his life, Parikshit was looking for Krishna, for that beautiful, wonderful figure that he had seen in the womb. And therefore, Parikshit means examiner. So he was examining everyone and everything. Where is Krishna? Always looking for Krishna, hoping to see Krishna again. This wonderful expansion of Krishna. Actually, Krishna came as the super soul, a four-armed form, and or the form of form of Vishnu. And although, of course, he was a great devotee of Krishna. So, before he was born, Yudhishthira inquired from the Brahmins about this child, just before Yudhishthira departed. And the Brahmins said he had all good qualities. They went on expansively about how he would be just, how he'd be a great emperor, how he'd be as powerful as his grandfather Arjuna. In other words, he was truly the right descendant of the Pandus with all of their good qualities. So his life is devoted to serving Krishna and also caring and protecting its citizens. as a great ruler, that was his main objective. His main duty was actually to care and protect others. And that protection extended to all living entities, not just the humans, but also to other living entities, and most particularly to the cows. And he's probably most famous of all of his pastimes about encountering the very, very distressed cow, who is, of course, Mother Bhumi, the earth, who was in great distress because this Kali was beating the bull Dharma. Dharma represents religious principles. Kali, it was described, was a sudra, but he was dressed as a king. Of course, that's obviously symbolic, and that's what we see today. Most of our leaders are shudras or less, disguised as kings, or disguised as if they are some kind of great leaders. And actually, they have very, very, very poor qualities and do not really have the qualities to make them suitable as leaders. So Kali was the first of these, the first basically fake leader, you know, dressed like a king, but really had no kingly qualities. And what was he doing? He was beating Dharma, the bull, so that Dharma was standing on one leg. Three of his legs were broken at that point. Now, of course, the four legs are the four legs of religion. The last one standing was the leg of truthfulness. And Maharaj Prakrit, when he encountered Kali, I always find this interesting because, well, we all have our natures, and some people are very merciful and kind and brahminical. I'm not so much. I always like the fact that Maharaj Prakrit, what was his first response? To take up his sword and kill Kali, to defend the cow, to defend the bull. In other words, he wanted to assure religious principles were enacted within his kingdom. But then later we see that he also had his merciful side. So this is a devotee. A devotee is strict with principles, but also merciful and kind to all living entities. And we see that these kings were called maharshis because they were great warriors, but they also were rishis. They also had spiritual knowledge, and they also had compassion to all living entities. So he was prepared to kill Kali, but Kali immediately realized, okay, this is up. This is over now. I'm finished. So he understood that Maharaj Prakrit could easily kill him. So he surrenders. He said he abandoned his kingly dress. He surrenders to Maharaj Prakrit. Now, what does a great warrior do when someone surrenders to them? They accept that, and then they extend mercy. Since he surrendered to him, that is the righteous nature of a real Kshatriya, of a real leader, of a real king. So he extended his mercy to him. And he said, I won't kill you, but you are banished from my kingdom. You are the prince. You represent the principles of irreligion, and I cannot have you in my kingdom. You must leave. You know, and he said, Kali says, but I have nowhere to go. You know, everywhere. Where can I go in your kingdom? You'll be there everywhere. You're in charge of everything. There isn't any place for me to go. So, and this reading from what happens next, I'll read from the Bhagavatam ones. This is chapter 17, 38 through 40. Maharaj Prakrit, thus petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. Okay, so he's got some places you can go where these, you know, irreligious activities are going on. Now, what's the problem? There aren't any such places under the kingdom of Maharaj Prakrit, right? The personality of Kali asked for something more. And because of his begging, the king gave him permission to live where there is gold. Because wherever there is gold, there's also falsity, intoxication, lust, envy, and enmity. Thus, the personality of Godhead, by the directions of Maharaj Prakrit, the son of Uttara, was allowed to live in these five places. And of course, after the reign of Maharaj Prakrit and probably Janmanjaya, these other places, you know, soon became more and more it became more prominent as Kali Yuga progressed. So once the age of Kali began, and of course this is why it's called Kali Yuga, the age of Kali. This is Kali personified, irreligious principle personified. Though those religious principles begin to decline, and the irreligious principles begin to increase. So as we see gambling, illicit sex, intoxication, and animal slaughter, the four regular principles, basically, described right in the Bhagavatam. What do we see? We see the decline of truthfulness, cleanliness, austerity, and mercy. These four that correspond with the four regular principles. So when these principles are broken, we see good qualities are lost. We see that in our basically human civilization goes downhill. It begins to decline, you know, because it's just automatic. You can't have animal slaughter and have mercy. It's a fact. You're going to, and we see, Prabhupada has explained that the karmic result of the animal slaughter is all the wars that we have. It's a direct line result of karmic reaction. I mean, there's no getting around it. There's going to be, because, you know, people no longer have mercy, they'll kill one another, they'll do anything, intoxication, all of these things are breaking down religious principles. Now, besides this, it's discussed here the accumulation of wealth, because Kali was also given the places where gold is accumulated. So Prabhupada explains how the accumulation of wealth also results in the breaking of the four regular principles or the four irreligious activities, and also the Bhagavatam says envy and enmity. So in other words, fighting amongst different people, envy of one another, these things come about through accumulation of wealth. If somebody has more than I have, then I want that. Somebody has something that others don't have, then there's going to be envy of that, and then there's going to be more and more strife. And so we see this. We see that people, you know, obviously fight over money, they fight over wealth. I mean, people kill each other over inheritances, it happens, you know. Not a lot, fortunately, but, you know, there's, what to speak of all of the wars, all of the struggle between one country and another. How often do these things trace back to simply one wants the other's land, or wants the other's resources, or the other's oil, or whatever it might be? It's this type of, you know, envy over wealth of others that leads to so many negative things in this Kali Yuga age. So, Robert explained, actually, that a Brahmin isn't so much interested in collecting money. Well, we may be interested in collecting money, but he immediately spends it in the Lord's service. He said a Brahmin brings in so much money that he gets donated to him, and then he immediately spends that in devotional service. So that's basically the formula. So the Brahmins remain, but not a lot of material assets. And I've always seen over the years, I think, that our temples and our devotees follow this very well. We don't seem to be able to ever really accumulate very much, and I think that's Krishna's arrangement. Because as soon as we have any money, what do? We find a new project or something that we need to spend the money on. Or Krishna arranges in that way. So these things are all going on by the will of the Lord. Sometimes I wish we had a little bit more and could do more in Krishna's service, but, you know, this is the way it is. Like once the devotees came to Prabhupada in Vrindavan, they said, this group, they want to give us this temple to manage. And Prabhupada said, we could have all of the temples. He said, but who would run them? Who would manage them? In other words, Krishna gives us what we're able to take care of, generally. And the more that we're able to take care of Krishna's property, Krishna's wealth, then Krishna gives us more to take care of. But then if we try to over-accumulate, you know, or think that this is mine, we don't understand this is all Krishna's, all coming from Krishna's, then Krishna will withhold it. Krishna will take it away. So we always have to have that mood that everything is Krishna's, nothing is mine, and everything I have is to be used in his service. Kind of a somewhat related story. I was just thinking about, in one of the memory tapes, Uttama Shloka talks about the purchase of the Toronto Temple. And he found this very nice church, which is the temple that Toronto has today. You know, very, very big building, very nice facility, huge temple room. Been there. And it's in a nice part of town, too. It's near the downtown area. It's probably very valuable now. Anyway, Uttama Shloka had seen this, and he goes to Prabhupada and said, I think we should buy this for our temple. And Prabhupada said, how much is it? And it was expensive for devotees. It was a lot of money. And Prabhupada said, we don't want to purchase anxiety. All you'll be needing is anxious about how you're going to pay for it. We don't need to purchase anxiety. He said, okay. Well, Prabhupada, you at least want to see it. Prabhupada said, well, all right. So he goes and looks at it, And then later, I don't know if it was right away or a couple of days later, Prabhupada says, I think we should get it. And Uttama Shloka says, but Prabhupada, we'll just be purchasing anxiety. And Prabhupada said, there must be anxiety. There must be anxiety for Krishna. We should always be anxious to serve Krishna. Again, you know, it's not like, all right, we might be a little impoverished, it might be difficult, it might be a struggle for us, but this will be wonderful for serving Krishna. He saw the value in this, how we could serve the deity so nicely with this facility and bring so many people to Krishna consciousness. So this was the mood of the devotees. Not that, you know, that doesn't mean that one can't be intelligent and, you know, they say that every nonprofit organization should have a certain amount of cash reserve. It's not that you necessarily are, you know, managed poorly and you don't have something for an emergency. In fact, that's even a principle, isn't it, of the householders should be, 25% of their money should be kept for emergencies. So in other words, having something for emergencies is not against our principles. But the point is, I think it's clear, we don't want to overaccumulate. We want to use everything for Krishna. So that last leg standing was truthfulness. And Srila Prabhupada explains that there is a little bit of truthfulness left in Kali Yuga. None of the others. The others are all gone. And it's interesting. I think these four religious principles are important for us to understand because this is really the basis of how we create culture and civilization through these religious principles. Once Prabhupada was saying, well, like, if, in other words, should the government, can we impose our religious beliefs on everyone? In other words, if we actually ran the government, do we make everybody be a Krishna conscious devotee? And Prabhupada said, you don't have to impose a particular belief. He said, but a ruler or a leader or a government head must encourage, the four principles of religion. In other words, we enforce the principles of religion, which really shouldn't be against any bona fide religious belief. Whatever religious belief is, how can you be against truthfulness, mercy, cleanliness, and austerity, right? These are just good things for people to do, good ways for human society to behave. So if those things are there, then that's the mode of goodness. And that gives the foundation. When the mode of goodness is established, then Krishna consciousness will flourish. People will come to Krishna consciousness if their brains are not just so completely covered, through sinful activity. Okay. So, truthfulness. Prabhupada says, there are different countries in different parts of the world, and each and every country may have different types of sacrifice to please the Supreme Lord. But the central point in pleasing him is ascertained by the Bhagavatam is truthfulness. The basic principle of religion is truthfulness, and the ultimate goal of all religions is to satisfy the Lord. Because if we extend that idea of truthfulness, ultimately, if we're looking for truth, we're talking about absolute truth, right? And we take truthfulness all the way to understanding, what is the truth of the universe, what is the truth of reality, we come to Krishna consciousness. So truthfulness is the basis. So it's not surprising, due to Kali Yuga, and due to that last leg shaking, as it's described, for truthfulness, that we don't see it so much. It's becoming more absent in modern society. It's the last leg of Dharma, and people do appreciate it. Many people, I think, do appreciate truthfulness, but it's still rapidly deteriorating to the point that we almost don't expect it anymore. We almost have come to expect deception in business, in the law, in politicians. It's just kind of like normal. There's some major leading newspapers that keep count. And as of, I've said and mentioned this before, but I want to give you an update here on Donald Trump and truthfulness. As of January 20th, so we're within about a month, now we're up to Trump has made 16,240 untrue or misleading statements. He's going for an all-time record of deception and untruth. I mean, it does, whatever you like of his politics or not his politics, the fact is, no one seems to really care. I mean, that's what is amazing. It's like, okay, that's what politicians do. You know, they lie or they exaggerate or whatever. You know, it's like we just expect it. We don't expect truthfulness, and we excuse a lack of truthfulness. Anyway, thus is Kali Yuga. Srimad Bhagavatam 8:24 says, there is nothing more sinful than untruthfulness. Because of this, Mother Earth once said, I can bear any heavy thing except a person who is a liar. The purport prophet says, even the most common dealings, people are accustomed to speaking so many lies. No one is free from the sinful reaction of speaking lies. Under the circumstance, one can just imagine how this has overburdened the earth and indeed the entire universe. So, Maharaj Parikshit is kind of making the last stand against Kali Yuga. You know, it's kind of like the last, you know, the last great leader to really ensure truthfulness and the other religious principles were kept on earth. And this is because he was a great, great devotee of Lord Krishna. He understood real religious purpose, real religious principle. Real religious principles are enacted by the Lord to please the Lord. So not only was his birth and his life glorious, but of course, obviously his passing away was glorious. So the story we know well, that Maharaj Parikshit was out and about hunting or whatever Kshatriyas do, had a hard day out there, driving around his chariot or his horses all day, and he was very tired, very hungry and thirsty. And so he came to a Brahmin's hut, and there was a Brahmin sitting meditating, and he asked him if he could just have a drink of water. Now, this is the emperor of the world. He comes to your house, all he wants is a drink of water. Most of us would say, yes, sir, whatever I can do for you. Right? But because he was in deep entrance, the Brahmin actually didn't hear him. He didn't mean to offend him. He didn't hear him. He was in trance. But Maharaj Parikshit didn't realize that. He thought he was just like snubbing him or wouldn't answer him. So he was a little bit mad, looked a little angry. And, of course, all by the will of the Lord, these pastimes go on. He saw a dead snake, and so he kind of picked up with his bow the snake, and he put it around the Brahmin's neck as a garland. Okay, no, I'll show you. Well, not a good thing to do. Unfortunately, the Brahmin had a son named Sringi. And Sringi was the son of a Brahmin, but he was the beginning of Kali Yuga Brahmins, which means Kali Yuga Brahmin, religious people who don't really know religion, who don't really understand the real religious principles. Because a true spiritual religious personality would understand, okay, this was a minor discretion, and this is a great devotee and a great king. But no, Sringi became angry, became upset on behalf of his father. You have offended my father. Therefore, I curse you to die in 7 days by the bite of a snake bird. So, Maharaj Parikshit heard this, and what did he do? It's actually described that he had the tejas, the power that he could have counteracted it. In fact, he had, at the very end, Kashyapa Muni even comes to try to counteract it, but he didn't. He accepts it. He accepts, okay, this is the will of the Lord. He said, and I have 7 days. What does one do when one has 7 days to live? You think, boy, I better see everything I can, enjoy everything I can, you know, really get everything I can out of life. I've got 7 days to do it. Sounds kind of foolish, doesn't it? Yeah. So Maharaj Parikshit was not foolish. He was very intelligent. He said, okay, I have 7 days. I want to hear the pastimes of the Lord. So he sits down to meditate on the bank of the river, and all the sages and saints come, and among them comes Shukadeva Goswami. And Shukadeva Goswami then was recognized by everyone. We just read about him just in the last verses. Recognized by everyone as, you know, the greatest, most pure devotee there. And so Shukadeva Goswami in 7 days recites the glories of Krishna and the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada said in the purport, Maharaj Parikshit didn't eat or didn't sleep for 7 days. That in itself is quite wonderful, quite a feat. And he simply raptly heard the Srimad Bhagavatam spoken by the lips of Shukadeva Goswami. Now, so this was, this is what he did. He understood, I'm not my body. I am the spirit soul, I'm the eternal, it's part and parcel of Krishna, I just want to hear about Krishna and Krishna's glories up until the moment of death. She did. And so, fortunately for all of us, this Srimad Bhagavatam, this beautiful story of the personality of Godhead, is recited and is left for us 5,000 years later by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada's translating to English with his purports. We have these wonderful stories, and we have so much knowledge of Krishna. So after 7 days, Maharaj Parikshit, that kind of like thanks Shukadeva Goswami, Shukadeva Goswami leaves. He sits back to the meditation, knowing his time is about up. The snake bird is approaching to bite him. So he was externally killed by the snake bird, but it's actually described that he was already in the spiritual world. He basically had really, for all intents and purposes, left his body. So Vishnuchakravarti Thakur says the bite of the snake bird had no purpose, really. Because he had already, by his own will and his spiritual power and strength, he had gone into complete meditation on Krishna and said he was in the spiritual world. He was no longer there on the earth planet. So, very, very glorious departure. And it reminds us, of course, of others. This is not uncommon. We have related to us through our scriptures stories of many great devotees who have had glorious departures. Think of Haridas Thakur and his departure, and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, like personally carrying him. So many things. Think of Bhishma Dev. Bhishma Dev was lying on his bed of arrows, shot through with arrows, like hundreds of them, laying down on that. And Bhishma Dev had the power to leave his body at will. So he's laying there for several days, waiting for what? Waiting for Krishna to appear. And then Bhishma Dev, while he's like, I mean, you can only imagine, it's got to be pretty painful. You're filled with arrows, a point of death, and he speaks wonderful philosophy. He's one of our Mahajans, and he has a whole chapter of philosophy that he speaks in the Bhagavatam. And then, at his will, when he has Krishna's feet grasping, gazing into the face of Krishna, gives up his body. Yeah. And of course, we can think of our own Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, of course, had a glorious birth in a Vaishnava family. He says his father was a pure devotee. Says this a few times. And Prabhupada describes how his father gave him deities about at the age of 4 that he could take care of. And he went to the Radha Govinda temple, and he described, I was just reading this yesterday, I was looking. He described how he'd go to the temple and see what they did, and he would imitate in his play with his own deities, serving the deities, and the Jagannath festivals, and all of these things. And then, of course, what we all know what happens later. That Srila Prabhupada comes to America at a very, very advanced age and starts a worldwide movement of Krishna consciousness. Takes Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement all over the world, starts 100 temples, makes thousands of devotees, translates dozens and dozens of books, millions and millions of books distributed all over the world. This is Prabhupada's glory. And then Prabhupada's departure. We all know how ill he was for some time. And it was very, very hard for the devotees, seeing Prabhupada so ill and so weak and frail and, you know, lost so much weight. And I wasn't there. I was going to go to India, but something I got delayed and I didn't go for his departure. But anyway... Srila Prabhupada continued his service to Krishna up to the last breath. So you've probably seen films where Prabhupada is there in the last few days and he's instructing his disciples. He can barely speak and he has the microphone and he's still translating Srimad Bhagavatam, performing his service to Krishna right up to the end. And so he showed us the example. He showed us the example of how to lead, how to live and how to die. You know, by always serving Krishna, thinking of Krishna, serving Krishna, Krishna's devotees right up to the very end. In these very last days, somebody would come and probably to inquire to them, be concerned about their health or something. You know, it's ironic almost. You know, it's like always concerned about others and always wanting to serve Krishna and give Krishna to others. So this is the devotee. Devotee is very, very, very special. And serving Krishna's devotees is very special. And so we are fortunate to be in this wonderful line of great devotees. It does go back all the way to Vyasadeva and Krishna ultimately. And so we not only have these stories from Bhagavatam, but we even have in our own lifetime, in our own memory, we've had this wonderful example of Srila Prabhupada, his life and his passing, that can give us great example, great comfort, great help, and knowledge that we can learn. We can learn what it means to be a devotee. So, very fortunate in that regard. And Maharaj Parikshit, again, is a wonderful example and a very, very glorious life. Okay. Finished. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. All glories to Maharaj Parikshit. Any other comments, questions? In fact, I might have forgotten nothing. I think I can hardly see you through a plant. I think it's you.
When you mentioned how Parikshit sat at the bank of the river and then all the sages came, mm-hmm. It just never occurred to me. I mean, that was a totally mystical
response. Because they all knew to come there?
Yes. Yeah. And how many sages? How many?
Lots. The exact number, I don't know. A lot.
How does it describe that? That they knew of this potential event, you know.
Oh, I'm sure probably Krishna, you know, told him in the heart.
Yeah.
And then maybe word spreads, you know.
So.
Oh, Krishna, he was the emperor of the world, remember. So, yeah. I mean, he was an important figure that everybody knew. And they all knew he was a great devotee as well as a great emperor. So I'm sure once word got out and they all came. But obviously Krishna arranges all this. It's true. How is it that they just all showed up? He's on a remote riverbank. Is there anything else? No? Okay, thank you all. Hare Krishna.
Jai Prabhupada.